You are listening to the Experience Points podcast for the week of April 3rd, 2019, and today we die twice.
Welcome back, everybody. This is the Experience Points podcast. My name is Scott Juster.
And I'm George Albor.
We are the co-creators of ExperiencePoints.net. It is a serious but not humorless conversation about video games. This is one of those episodes where we talk about them. Video games, we got them.
We got them. You got them. We got them. Who got them? I got them.
We got them. Video games, we got them everywhere. Every which way.
Hashtag we got them.
George and I have been playing some video games, and so we're going to do a quick rundown of what we've been playing. Oh, also, I didn't even think about this when we were doing our pre-pro. We're going to start a new mini-series here.
Oh, yeah. Join on in, everybody. Hop on that bandwagon.
Yeah, here, this is the announcement. We are going to play Final Fantasy VII and do a series of debriefs on it. We're going to play the whole thing, debrief bit by bit, and relive 1997. You got your JNCOs ready?
It's like it was yesterday. We did this a way long time ago, and we played Chrono Trigger.
And
we did Earthbound. Apparently, yep. We just do RPGs.
Yeah, apparently, like JRPGs specifically.
Yeah. But funnily enough, they are some of the more listened to episodes, yeah, and some of the more frequently requested episodes. Apparently, there's a lot of people out there who like to play old video games and want to hear people talk about them in excruciating detail.
Yeah, so we decided we couldn't wait till the Final Fantasy VII remake, which I'm sure is just around the corner any day now. We're going to get it. Now. And so we are playing Final Fantasy VII. There's actually a number of ways of playing that now. Like, you can play it on the PC. There's definitely re-releases of it.
Yep.
I'm playing on the Switch right now.
I am also playing on the Switch.
I'm pretty sure there's even a phone version of it. I don't know that for a fact, but I'm pretty sure they ported that stuff.
You have options to play along with us.
Yeah. I think it's going to be a little bit... I'm still working on how we're going to divvy it up, but the first episode of the Final Fantasy VII debrief series will be from start to getting out of Midgar.
Yes.
It's a pretty logical endpoint. Like, getting out of Midgar is like the first big chunk of the game, and that sets up a lot of the stuff. So if you're playing along, the first episode will be discussing all the way up through leaving Midgar for the first time.
Yeah, and we'll probably give you a heads up as we approach that date, since we'll be talking about it as we go. Yeah.
Did you start playing it already?
I did. You know, there's an X3 button where you can just go move three times as fast through the dialogue?
Not only that, there's a three times the speed button. There is a no random encounters button.
That's right.
And there is a full limit break at any time button.
What?
Yep.
Wow, I did not know that.
That's the right. So if you click in the right stick during battle, it just fills all of your meters.
Man, next time I just want to fuck, like, I'm frustrated and just want to cheese a boss. I don't know if we, okay, well, you know, at least let's make sure that we at least give a good old college try.
Yeah, we'll have a gentleman's agreement with ourselves and the audience that we won't just be breezing.
Fuck you, Sephiroth. Ah! Wow, interesting. That's funny.
I mean, that will be a whole part of the conversation of just, like, what we're looking for in a remake, since, you know, that this... The game's, what, 21, 22 years old now, so it's interesting what they've done to modernize parts of it.
Yeah, crazy. Well, that'll be fun, so look forward to that.
All right, what games are you playing?
So I do want to talk about Sekiro Shadows Die Twice extremely badly, but I think we should save that for last.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start us off by saying I've been playing, I actually recently finished a game called Far Lone Sails. And this was requested by Brad Galloway on Twitter, who was like, hey guys, play this game, it's really cool. He described it specifically as Journey with Cars. You don't have to try very hard to get me to play a game if you're willing to just say it's Journey with Cars.
You'd be like, hey guys, it's kind of like Journey, done.
Yeah, I mean, basically, if someone was like, it's like Dark Souls meets Journey meets I'm already out the fucking window, I'm running to GameStop because I presume they still sell video games and are open these days.
There's just like a dust cloud that looks like you in the place where you were in the conversation.
Yeah, exactly. So hats off to Brad Galloway. He writes over at GameCritics.com. He also does podcasts and stuff. Good guy. Very great recommendation because this game is very good.
Okay, I have not started playing it yet, so... hit me with it. What is it?
So this is a, how would you just, besides Journey with a car, mm-hmm. it's basically, it's kind of like if you've played Lovers in a Dangerous Space-Time or okay. FTL, where you are one individual, a small individual, manning a very large machine. In this case, a car that also happens to have a sail on top of it.
Mm-hmm.
And your stature is very small, and so you have to bounce around the machine in order to operate it. So you're pushing this massive button to turn on the engine, and then you have to go and pick up a barrel and take the barrel to a separate room where you put it inside of a shaft, hit another button to fill the energy meter, and it slowly starts adding on mechanics. So at first you're just push and go and refueling, and then you are repairing pieces of your car that might start getting on fire, or if it's busted and you need to repair it with like a welding torch. You have a limited amount of fuel as well, so you are stopping your car when you have the opportunity to pick up barrels or basically anything. Essentially, you could just shove like chairs or whatnot to fuel this machine. And so you're sort of filling this engine and basically getting as far as you can until you need to stop and refill. The game is punctuated with a bunch of puzzles as well. So you'll eventually hit some barrier, let's say a bridge that's down. You'll have to get out of your car, solve some small puzzle, get back into your car, and then continue to progress. And that's basically it. The background of the world is sort of this quiet post-apocalyptic landscape, sort of muted black and white color throughout much of the game. And it's kind of solitary and quiet and really pretty to look at, and you're just moving from left to right in the sort of Journey-esque way, and it's very good. It's super calming and super chill. It's very zen. It's a very zen game, I would say, and if you're into that kind of like little macromanage-y kind of play style, I would give it a strong recommend.
So if you were mentioning it was similar in mechanics to Dangerous Space Time and FTL, but is it that same format of like you are X and there are X plus one things to do? Like, are you constantly like shorthanded, or is it not as stressful as like as those games?
So it's interesting because it does walk that border, right? Like the game I think would be boring if it wasn't X plus one, and it is always that, right? Like by the time that, so for example, there's also a steam gauge, so the more that your car goes, it builds up steam, right? So you have to remember to exhaust the steam before it causes problems for your vehicle. And so usually in the beginning, the time it takes to turn on the engine, refill the gas, and exhaust the steam is this like small little cycle that you get used to, right? And then you start adding other mechanics like raising the sail when the wind is in your favor and lowering it when it's not.
Okay.
Or turning on a suction thing on the back of your car to automatically pick up gear. And then just even moving the fuel sources around your car, because there's limited space and you don't want to get it in the way. So there's a little bit of, you know, managing your home kind of thing. And all of that together means you're always busy doing something and there's always something to be done. But it's never really pushed to such an extreme that you feel overwhelmed, right? There's There's no fail state in this game. You know, even if you run out of fuel, you can actually just drag your car manually forward with like a pulley until you encounter another piece of gear. And you can also just load up your car with a random shit you find on the road and shove that into the engine, and you're off to the races. Eventually, you start loading in things that are explosive, which will completely fill up the energy in your car, but you'll also need to put out a fire because, of course, it's a little bit damaging to it.
Right.
And so, you know, when you're later in the game, you are definitely running around and doing a lot of things and managing that system, but it only ever gets to the point where you feel like a master of that space, barely handling the challenges that come your way, not being overwhelmed. And I think that's a very fine line to walk, and I think they walk it really well because I think it is really easy to slip into something where it becomes tedious or boring or distracting or overwhelming and unfun. And I think they manage to have it still be a challenge at times and interesting because you're moving around and doing a lot of things, but also building in a slow pacing at times to appreciate the landscape, appreciate the gorgeous music, and just kind of zone out.
Is it a story game?
It's not. I mean, there's no real story at all. There is a story told in the environment in the background. Like there, you know, there are photos and you slowly discover, you know, maybe who you are or, or the background of like who created this world and how it resulted in this thing. But that's basically it. I mean, there's not, there's no dialogue whatsoever. There's no diary entries. It is a very small game. It's made by five individuals. So it's a very small team as well. And I think they just released actually on the consoles, but it's been available on Steam for a few months now. And yeah, I would highly recommend it. I think it's pretty great.
It's cool. I'll definitely take a look at it. It sounds compelling. Usually that sort of Diner Dash Overcooked style game is not described as contemplative. So it's cool to see that take of it.
Yeah, for sure. And it's pretty short as well. Like you'll finish it in maybe 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah. Cool. Me?
Yes, you.
Okay. Let me talk to you about a game that I started playing but did not finish.
Okay. Is it because it's bad?
Okay.
Take your time.
Okay, I played this game. So this was a funny game because I just saw the title and I was like, I'm just gonna play this blind, because the name is The Liar Princess and the Blind Prince. I just saw it, you know, on the whatever the Nintendo game market is called. I was like, all right, I'm gonna try this out. And basically what it is a 2D side-scrolling adventure game. And the reason why I wanted to play in the first place is, one, the title was evocative, and two, the artwork was kind of neat. It was somewhat animated, somewhat Japanese animated, but also a kind of sketchy pop-up book type look to it.
Yeah, I'm looking at images right now, and it looks kind of... like Omori, like kawaii Japanese.
Yeah,
aesthetic.
It has a manga. Taste about it.
But also a macabre sort of like over the garden wall look. Like everything.
Yeah,
has
I mean
sort of
it's weird. Like and the plot of it is that there's this wolf creature that entrances this prince with its beautiful singing. And then when the prince comes to see it, the wolf overreacts and slashes at the prince because it's, you know, scared of humans and trying to get away and accidentally blinds the prince.
Bummer.
And so what happens then is it feels bad. It's basically like a fairy tale. It's kind of like one of those Grimm style fairy tales where it's like, man, there's a lot of weird body horror to this thing.
Did say Japanese.
I mean, it is very, I like the themes of it quite a bit. And so it follows this idea of the wolf goes back to the now blind prince and tries to make good, where it's like, okay, I made a mistake here. You know, I'm going to appeal to a witch with magical powers to give me the ability to, you know, fix this prince. And, you know, the rest of the game is basically you leading the prince around. There are echoes of something like Ico, where it's not quite an escort mission because your partner can do things, but you still have to kind of direct this prince around the screen to solve puzzles and to navigate the environment and so forth. And I like the themes, and I thought the art style and the music was good, but the gameplay just fell flat. And it was one of those things where there was just enough mechanical rigor to be annoying. Like, the platforming is not good, but it's also not easy. And so it's like, man, what am I even doing here? Like, this doesn't feel good. It's not designed great. Like, it's pretty rudimentary. And yet, it's fairly exacting in a weird way, where it just feels like kind of a bad browser game from kind of the early 2000s. And so I ended up stopping. And I think I ended up stopping maybe like 2/3 or 3/4 of the way through, which is kind of a shame. But it was an interesting experiment that just didn't turn out so great.
Yeah. It says this is by Nipponichi, who did Disgaea. So
there's that.
Yeah, there is that. It actually doesn't look like that. I mean, besides the like kind of sort of cute characters, it's kind of surprising, to be honest.
Yeah, it didn't look like much else out there, and I hadn't played something that either looked like this or this kind of weird platforming adventure for a while. So took a chance, didn't quite work out, but you know, not a horrible game, just something that I couldn't. Sekiro was waiting. You know what I'm saying?
I gotta say, like, there's a lot of weird stuff on the Nintendo eStore.
Yep.
These days. Totally. I mean, including like things that look, let's be perfectly honest, like very hyper sexualized Ero games almost.
Oh yeah. Right? There's like, a lot of like new style bubblegum crisis sort of vibe going on.
Yeah, like sexy maids and like weird shit like that. I mean, so take that with a grain of salt, but I think that blind buying random games on the eShop is the way to go sometimes because they're pretty cheap, you know?
Exactly. It doesn't really put you back anything. It's just kind of, all right, let's test this out.
You might find a gem.
Yeah. What else? What else are you playing?
So I'll talk about this very briefly because technically I'm biased, but I have been playing The Division 2.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
By Ubisoft, where I work. So I didn't pay it. I got this game for free. And I'll just say a little bit about it because, again, like I don't want to...
Tell me about the Dark Zone.
I haven't gone to the Dark Zone. Oh, and here's the thing. Like, I really enjoyed The Division 1, which I played before I started at Ubisoft. I thought it was a really solid game. I got to the end game, didn't seem all that compelling. I ended up stopping in the way that you do with Schluters, right? Which is if nobody else is playing, I'm not going to play the Schluter anymore. This one is very, very good. And I think one of the things that I just want to call out before moving on is that the team was really smart in having it set in DC. And I think when that decision was announced, I thought, well, I don't know anything about DC, so it's not going to be interesting. What I realize now is one of the reasons they set it there is that they can have a lot of indoor missions that take place in very iconic and interesting locations. Like in The Division 1 in New York, great setting, but there were a lot of locations that were basically, you're fighting in a mall, now you're fighting in another mall, now you're fighting in an office building. In this one, you were fighting at like a NASA center. Now you're fighting at like a historical museum. There's this really amazing mission that takes place early in the game where you're fighting through a Vietnam, like a history exhibit about the Vietnam War. And so it has these like weird vibes. There's other sections where you're fighting in like large public libraries. And having those indoor settings and changing up those environmental missions feels so good. And it's super strong when it's like, oh, wow, I remember that mission. And I can describe it because of just the bizarre setting I'm in. Like, it's not just interesting because the enemies are placed in interesting ways, even though they are, but just the environments themselves are really cool. And I don't know, that feels very clever to me because it's something that I didn't give them the benefit of the doubt before going into it, thinking that it made sense to be set in a place like DC that genuinely in real life has an insane number of like historical places and places of interest. So,
yep. I've heard some cool things about how they balance out the multiplayer in terms of making sure that people can still play with each other, even if they're leveled differently, or making it fairly seamless as to like, oh, if you're in this chapter in the story, we won't just lock you out because your friend isn't in the same chapter. Like basically it seems like the anti Monster Hunter. And I thought that sounded really cool just in terms of, because your whole challenge with a game like this is to get people to play it in a massive way because there's just so many other games that require coordination between friends and it's just a crowded market. Yeah. And so it's cool to reduce friction as much as possible there.
If it wasn't for Sekiro, I would be playing it significantly more.
Right. Yeah, it sounds cool. Well, I'm glad. I'm glad that it sounds cool. And it was one of those, I mean, classic story. Like, I feel like the first game had a pretty long tail. It was worked on for a long time after release. Yeah. Like, this seems like a natural continuation to a game that became very popular.
And it'll still be there if I ever finally beat Sekiro.
Right. It's a big if.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Babo Is You?
Yes. There is a great game out. Well, okay.
okay. Hold on the great.
Hold on the great, because it is a great game, but it's one of those games that I'm instantly frustrated at, like angry. I realize my approach to a lot of puzzle games is almost like I see the mechanic, and then I think three steps ahead of how they're going to just screw me with the mechanic in later levels. And I'm like, oh, and fuck lo and behold, you. Yeah, like...
Is this a slide puzzle game?
Okay, so that, I think that I was actually going to use that exact term. I think the best way to describe this game is it is a slide puzzle game with logical operators that change the rules of the puzzle.
Okay, so you can... Okay, because I'm looking at images, and it looks like it was made in, like, MS Paint.
It has a very... I mean, this feels like some 2009 indie shit. It makes me feel very nostalgic for, like, the early days of our podcast.
I mean, it looks good, and it's called Baba Is You. Like, yeah. I'm very intrigued. Are you playing this on the Switch, by the way?
I am. Okay. Perfect Switch game, because each level is one screen, and the entire, you know, the screen is the slide puzzle, and it's a top-down thing where... You start as this little weird rabbit creature named Baba, and then on the level itself is... So everything... Sorry, okay, one step back. Everything is arranged in squares, tiles. So then there are words on the screen, like Baba is you, and those are three words. Each word is a square, so you can push those squares around. So okay. Baba is both a word and a pushable object in the slide puzzle.
Okay.
And so what you can do is push around the words to create different logical expressions that change the rules of the slide puzzle.
So if you were to say slide a box in front of is, are you now a box?
It's a word. So the words are the logic that controls the environment, and then the environment is what is interacted with. So if you slide the word flag in front of is you, then all of a sudden you're controlling the flag.
Huh. Okay. That's pretty cool.
And so you'll see something that says like wall is stop, which means you can't, you know, the walls will stop you. But if you break that logical expression, all of a sudden the walls are meaningless. You can just go through them, do whatever you want to them.
Oh, interesting. Oh man, this is an indie-ass indie game. I love it.
So eventually you can start to link logical expressions together where it's like, Baba is flag is you, which turns Baba into a flag. So there's now two flags running around, but you're controlling both of them.
Oh, interesting. And disjointed. So you can like push it in a certain way to be in the right position.
So, yeah, I mean, and then you might need to break a certain wall or you can turn yourself into the wall and move huge sections of the walls in the level. And so basically you just need to you need to create a condition that wins the slide puzzle, which is itself a logical operator. So most of the time it starts off with flag is win. So if you touch the flag, you win. But you can create a different logical operator to make a different win condition.
That's awesome. Like stop is win. And then if you just stop moving, you win.
I forget which one I might have done like a Baba is win, and then all of a sudden like if you turned into you just won.
Hell yeah, dude. George is also win. Did you know that? Side note, one of my coworkers' name is Win, so technically Win is Win.
There you go. I mean, you can't argue with the logic, right?
Yeah. So why did you stop playing? I mean, this actually sounds pretty neat.
I didn't stop playing. I just sometimes I rage out at it. I get vibes like, you know, remember when we were playing The Witness and every once in a while we'd just be like, fuck you, fuck this game, fuck everything about this. Like,
yeah.
I've definitely already had moments with this game where it's just like, it's usually when the puzzles are so simple, but I still can't figure them out for some reason. Like there's just one thing that I can't slide into place. And I'm like, God damn. I'll uncover a mechanic and I'll be like, oh, that was a clever mechanic. And then I'll think about it. Oh man, they're going to screw me so hard with this mechanic, like three levels later. And then lo and behold, they do it.
Baba is sad.
Yeah. I would also. I wonder if they make Baba Is You T-shirts. I would get a T-shirt with Baba Is You stuff.
I played Magic the Gathering this past weekend against a guy who was wearing a Witness shirt.
Oh my god!
Or the Witness shirt, yeah.
And was he wearing glasses? Did you like poke the round part and be like, no, it's a puzzle?
I should have. Yeah, I should have made a Witness joke. I kind of didn't want to shit on it at all, so I just kept quiet.
So if you can't say something nice,
you know, if you can't say something nice about the Witness, don't say anything at all.
I highly recommend Baba Is You, though. It is a $15 Switch game. There seem to be dozens of levels, so there's a lot there, and I definitely have not finished it yet.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. It looks like it was also an Ichigo game, so I wonder if it was like a Game Jam build.
I think so. I get the sense that this is, again, everything around this screams independent game scene, which is also pretty charming.
Yeah. All right, should we spend a little bit talking about Sekiro?
Let's do it, because I feel like we might, if we ever can finish this game, we'll probably do a deeper debrief on it.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's why I'm glad we save it for last, because that way we kind of have, like, a time stop.
Yeah.
You know, I was scared that if we talked about Sekiro first, we would take the whole podcast talking about
easily.
It. So, you've been playing it. I've been playing
oh,
it.
Oh, yeah.
We're huge Soulsborne fans.
Yep.
Platinumed Bloodborne. I have at last gotten good. Sekiro, what do you think, Scott?
Is it weird to feel vicariously proud of From Software?
You've done it, son.
I mean, it does kind of feel like that, where again, I have no stake in this, nor do I know anyone who works there, but playing this game, it makes me feel proud, where it's like, not only are you doing something that is markedly different from what you've done before, but it feels great. It's like, man, you guys really took a risk, you know, and got outside of the normal comfort zone, and you're just soaring. Like, this is great.
When I realized how different it was, and I think the thing that people will cite over and over again, and you've probably heard by now, is that it punishes dodge rolling in a way that none of the series have before.
Yep.
Right? Where it's much more, you know, you have to sit there and time your blocks in this really specific way. And that realization came to me in much the same way some of the realizations about the Bloodborne mechanics came to me, or using shields and parrying in Dark Souls, right? Like, that disjuncture between those two games was significant, and it threw people off who were familiar with one or the other. Yep. This is another case where it feels markedly different from either of those two games. And you're right, it is a kind of proud feeling to know, wow, you did do something that is very different, still feels in that vein, but is very different, and still is, like, rock solid. You know, it's still very clean. It doesn't feel as though they're sort of forcing their way into a mechanic that's different just as a gimmick. You know, like, the game seems very built from the ground up with that sort of blocking and measured control of combat in mind.
I mean, it is the, for folks that haven't paid too close of attention to it, it is, the theme is feudal Japan, and it's very much a samurai sword fighting game.
Yep.
And in the same way that, like, Bushido Blade or Samurai Gun or any of those, like, so many of your encounters are basically one hit kills once you break someone's stance. Yep. In the way that, you know, a million animes are a guy runs at you with a sword, swings, and then 3 seconds later, a geyser of blood, you know, comes out of someone's neck.
Dude, I was, like, fighting in an area where there was a bamboo forest, and I was slicing through the bamboo, being like, this is so fucking, this is like Ninja Scroll. I'm in. My, like, 8-year-old self would have loved this.
Totally.
Yeah.
What are your impressions of it, though? I mean, like, I've only played a few hours of it, but you played a little bit more.
Yeah, I'm pretty deep. I like it quite a bit, and I think the difference between it and the preceding Soulsborne games is important to me. Like, I'm glad that it's different. I think that I'm going to end up waxing poetic about this game a lot on future debriefs. So instead, I'm going to throw shade on the game.
Okay.
And a couple of things that I have problems with.
No patches, right?
No
patches.
Yeah,
the hyena is not
there
yet.
I mean, I would not be surprised if patches showed up somewhere. There's definitely a lot of, like, interesting and optional side stories. I mean, the game really opens up at some point.
Yeah.
I think that there are mini boss fights that have too many mobs on their way to them.
Mm.
And the process of learning those is frustrating, because there's so much ad cleanup that you have to do. Okay. And I think part of that reason is because I don't think that the stealth mechanics are as strong as they could be.
Mm-hmm.
Based upon other stealth, like, this is just the stealth system in this game, while following the conventions of other stealth games, is just not as clean. You know, this is no, what's that game where you're, like, teleporting on rooftops?
Teleporting on rooftops. I don't know.
Dishonored.
I just keep on Dishonored. Yeah.
Like, this is no Dishonored, right? Like, it is not a peak stealth game.
Right.
Because it is primarily a fighting game, and stealth is a sort of secondary thing, but a lot of the systems are built up on that. But, you know, when you are, there are some boss fights where, like, so for example, I don't know if you've encountered it yet, but there's a mini boss called the Shinobi Killer, right? Mm. And there's a bunch of ads around it. And really the optimal way for you to encounter that fight is by killing a bunch of ads, running away, killing the ads, running away, killing the last ad, running away, and then resetting the fight, right? Mm-hmm. When you die on that fight, it's really annoying to have to go and kill those ads again. And I understand that if this is skippable, you can come back, etc. But
right.
I think that there are some moments like that that are just not perfectly executed. And I think it's partially because the stealth system isn't as reliable as it could be. Mm-hmm. So that's one complaint. Hmm. My second is, and I think this is going to be contentious, and it already has been contentious amongst Soulsborne fans. Mm-hmm. I think it was a really big mistake not to have multiplayer in Sekiro.
I was shocked that at a certain point I had basically gone on blackout for the game because I knew I was going to play it anyway, so I just stopped right. paying attention to it. And I was shocked when I dipped back in and realized that there was no multiplayer.
Yeah, and look, I get the reasons why, right? Like, people have talked about how, or FromSoft has specifically said, this has enabled them and empowered them to design for a single player, that they can mm-hmm. create bosses that are balanced for just one player instead of two. They yep. can build levels that are constructed in such a way that allows this to happen. They can add the pause feature in the game, because now you don't have to have the state where, you know, yeah. you can't pause in the middle of combat. You can pause. And that's great for people, especially people who need a little bit of time or patience or need to take mm-hmm. a break or whatever. Like, I get it. And I think all of those reasons are completely valid reasons. But, you know, I was playing the game the other day and I was thinking about some of the cool little story moments that I discovered and some of the cool little secrets that I had discovered. And I was realizing that one of the ways that I've most enjoyed this game is by talking about it with friends while playing it. And mm-hmm. sometimes that means I'm not playing with them. You know, like, there are times when I've been on a call with a buddy and we're each playing Bloodborne, waiting to get to the same spot so that we can co-op, right?
Yeah.
And while we wait, we're shooting the shit and we're talking about that co-op moment. Or some of the most memorable moments are both of us discovering, you know, the Bloodborne DLC together, or us mm-hmm. helping a friend get through a difficult challenge together. Those moments of conversations and talking about it, I think, happened primarily because we could play in co-op at all. And that's an experience that you are having outside of the core mechanics. So I understand mm-hmm. that, you know, like, the actual joy of defeating a boss together might be less because we're kind of cheesing it and we're bouncing off aggro or whatever. But I think that the sacrifice is more than just mechanics here, right? Like, it's more than just, oh, I can't kill a guy, or I can't cheese this boss with my friend. By not having a multiplayer, you are making those moments where you're talking about it and exploring it together more rare. Like, I have to have those conversations in person now because I'm not in a party chat with the person that I'm playing right. with, you know?
Right. How do you feel about the... I don't know the best way to describe it. It's not that they made it easier. I guess they just made things more transparent. Like, I was shocked when I picked up some items and it told me exactly what the items did.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and even the upgrade systems is so streamlined. It's insane.
Yeah.
I think that's great. I mean, I think it makes the game far more accessible than it's ever been. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit sad that I can't really sort of like min-max or design the character that I really want to. There's no fashion souls, for example, which is a huge bummer, but, you know, right. whatever. But yeah, I mean, it's for sure more accessible. I also think it makes the individual mini-boss battles that much more significant, because you know that, mm-hmm. well, I'm not going to be able to go and grind away, but right. this mini-boss is my last prayer bead that I need in order to mm-hmm. increase my health. Right. So when you defeat that mini-boss, it's so much more impactful, because it's not just, oh, this is just the person getting in my way. This is the one and only way that you have of improving your own stats.
Right, right. Yeah, I think I feel fine because it's so different from the Souls. It really just further differentiates Dark Souls as its own thing, where it's like, oh, the opaque nature of it is just part of that game, not part of the subgenre that game has created.
Yeah.
And it's cool to see them take a swing at just doing something much more straightforward, in that it's not about figuring out the mechanics or the rules of the items. The game is so much more about just pure execution.
Yes. Yeah.
Whereas, like, it's not about your, I mean, obviously it is somewhat about your build and somewhat about your items and such, but not to the extent that something like Dark Souls is.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just so much more like you know, I hope that you're playing with a low latency controller because you're going to need to be parrying, son. And it's like, yes. Uh-oh.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it does make those boss wins so much more satisfying. Like a while back, yeah. I shared the boss fight when you're first, I think it's one of the first boss, I forget his name, Gonichiro or something. He's the guy rides the general. Horse. Uh-huh. Yeah. And that horse boss, like, took me a really long time to get. But when I finally beat him, it was such a fucking clean run. Like, I got hit once, and I was like, man, that was so sharp and so polished that I was just really proud of that because it was all executional. You know, I wasn't cheesing. I didn't figure it out. I didn't, like, just add a bunch of stuff. It's just that I got very good at fighting that particular boss, and I executed it so cleanly. I rewatched my own boss fight like 3 times, just going, damn, George, like, clean. Like, you're dodging right. And in a weird way, it's very positive to have that positive encouragement from myself, because it's reminding me when I go into the next boss battle, you know, be clean, to pace yourself, like, understand what's happening and why it's happening. You know, you have to encourage that level of interrogating your playstyle and the boss's moveset in a way that I think you generally have to do in other Soulsborne games too, but now you really don't have an excuse because you have to do it. You have to figure it out. You can't just spam an attack or something, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that, to me, that is the biggest difference so far, which is where Dark Souls by design is somewhat squishy. Like, you should be able to somewhat cheese it because the bosses are going to do the same thing to you. Like, Dark Souls is fighting in the fog, whereas Sekiro is fighting under the blinding noontime sun, where it's just like nothing is hidden, you know. Like, it's just you versus this other thing, and you're gonna have to be exact to do it. And it's cool that they picked such a different approach to it, but it still feels very much like a From Software style game. Yeah.
And even the things that you can cheese, it feels like they know that you can cheese it, you know? Yeah. Like, the reason that mini bosses have 2 lives is because they're letting you get 1 stealth kill. But that's all you get, motherfucker. Like, you better ready yourself, because I'm coming at you as soon as you take that stock off me.
I also like, so far I've liked the, we always talk about the setting and, like, what sorts of Souls game settings are out there. And it's cool to see them take a completely different aesthetic and mythology and do something with it.
Yeah, the mythology is definitely working for me. I still wish it were in a modern setting somehow. You know, but
we'll give it time. You might loop into the real world at some point.
Hey, I mean, there's already elements where I'm like, is that a Bloodborne connection? So
I mean, one of the first fucking things I did was, like, I took a shortcut underneath a bridge and I found a freaking troll down there, and I was like, what is this?
He had, like, that's funny.
Yeah, I don't even know, because it was definitely before they were going to introduce any of the supernatural stuff. I was just like, it was like it was on the first mission where you're trying to get out of the compound and then whistle for your master to escape the bridge.
Yeah.
And I went under the bridge in that level, and there was a little troll creature under there.
Did you kill it?
Yeah.
Good man.
Of course.
Of course I killed it. What are you talking about? Of course.
It's a From Software game. It's kill or be killed.
Dude, I have, like, stealth walked up to so many NPCs just being like, do I got to stab you in the back? Okay, you're cool. Also, you're once cool. I talked to it and that motherfucker turned on me.
Now that's the From Software experience. Yes,
that is the Sekiro I knew and expected.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to playing more of it and just getting through the end of it, because I want to see what they do with it, you know, from start to finish, and also do the debrief.
Yeah, we'll definitely talk about it again.
Yeah, cool. Well, hey, man, it's end of March, beginning of April, and games are flying at us.
It is the season.
Yeah. What else? You know, there's a couple other games that are coming up pretty soon. I'm going to mess with Yoshi's Woolly World pretty soon. And I feel like there's one other that is coming out. I forget what it is, though.
Too many.
I don't know. Obviously, I just remember thinking that the first half of the year is really heating up.
All I've been doing is thinking about Sekiro, so Whatever is going to come next. So now it's
like
next,
I'm born again.
It's going to be like a surprise. Like, all I do now is play Magic Arena and play Sekiro.
And sharpen my katana.
And think about, like, literally I go to bed thinking, how do I want to approach that boss tomorrow? Or like, oh, right, I remember I have an item that probably unlocks some shit, so.
Yeah, it's great. We'll stay tuned for more of it. We'll leave it there for today. ExperiencePoints@gmail.com is our email address.
And ExperiencePoints.net is our shogun temple. Come on down, polish your swords at our fire.
I'll be the guy in the corner carving 1,000 different Buddha statues.
Oh man, dude, that guy puts in work.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you next week.
Ciao. Every time.